Hey there, how's it going? Seth here. Before we get into today's show, I wanted to let you know about the Seller Financing Masterclass. That's right, this is a brand new course from RE Tipster. You can see everything you need to know at sellerfinancingmasterclass.com. If you're a buyer or seller, and if you've ever wondered what kind of potential there is in buying or selling your properties with seller financing, or maybe you've even tried to do this before, but something about it just didn't go that well. Believe me, there are a ton of things that can and will go wrong with seller financing if you don't really understand what you're doing. I experienced this firsthand early on in my career, and I know many other real estate investors who have been through a very similar thing, all because they took some course that told them to do seller financing, but it didn't actually explain the ins and outs of how to do it properly. And I know even more real estate investors who won't even touch seller financing because they're terrified of it. And that's why I created the Seller Financing Masterclass, because I know what an amazing tool seller financing is as a real estate investor, and I also know all the pitfalls of doing this the wrong way. I've seen a lot of folks get into seller financing, particularly in the land investing space, without really understanding how to do it properly, how to screen and underwrite borrowers, how to set up the right terms and conditions in their loan documents to keep them in control, how to find a quality attorney in their state or handle the foreclosure process if they need to, and sometimes without even knowing the best ways to collect payments and manage their note portfolio. And when you don't know how to address all these things, seller financing isn't going to go well for you. And at this point in my career, I have been shocked at how many people are doing seller financing wrong because nobody ever explained the finer details to them. And believe me, there are some very important details you need to know. They're not particularly difficult or complicated, but you do need to know them. It's not enough to just try to do a seller finance deal without understanding which steps you need to go through to get the job done. And in the Seller Financing Masterclass, we're going to fix all of that so you understand exactly what to do. And what's even better is that it's not just my expertise you're going to be learning from. You're going to hear it from several other experts who are very astute in how to handle the ins and outs of owner financing. And also, very important, the goal of this course is not to push you to do seller financing for every deal. In fact, depending on your goals, seller financing oftentimes won't be the right fit. And my goal is to help make sure you understand when it makes the most sense so that when you want to go there, you'll have the best set of instructions on how to implement this. This is your doorway to an amazing opportunity in the real estate business. And I should also mention, if you enroll now during this initial launch phase we're in, you'll get a nice big discount on this course. So again, just go to sellerfinancingmasterclass.com. And you'll see everything you need to know. And with that, let's get into today's show. Hey folks, how's it going? This is Seth Williams, and you're listening to the RE Tipster Podcast, episode 173. And for years, I've wanted to find someone out there who specializes in solar energy because, as land investors, when we're looking at a prospective deal, depending on the property, this can be a pretty brilliant way to monetize a parcel of land. And this was actually one of the infamous monetization strategies I talked about in one of the most viewed videos on our YouTube channel called 7 Ways to Make $1,000 per Month from Vacant Land. And ever since that video came out, I've been working to, you know, find experts in each of these different fields to explain in more detail how you actually make money from things like wind turbines or cell phone towers or RV storage parks and that kind of thing. And I've been waiting patiently for a solar energy expert to reveal themselves to me, and they finally did. And this guy is Dakota Malone. And Dakota reached out to me recently to pitch this idea to come on the podcast. And I was like, yes, please, let's do it. That's perfect. And today I'm going to grill Dakota on how this industry works and how to determine when this strategy makes sense for a vacant parcel of land. And as usual, we're going to pick up a lot of other tidbits along the way. So Dakota, welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing amazing. Thank you so much for having me, Seth. I know that it's always a risk when you have strangers reaching out to you, but I appreciate you taking the swing on me.
Absolutely. So, aside from the little I just said to introduce you, who is Dakota Malone? What is your background and experience in the solar energy sector?
Sure. Yeah, I'd love to give you a brief background. So again, my name is Dakota. I was born and raised in central New York area, upstate New York, currently living in the Midwest down in St. Louis. And I've been in the energy space for over a decade at this point. So I just recently turned 30. It's crazy that I've been doing it for this long already. But essentially, I went to community college, got my 2-year degree, handed it to my parents and asked them to leave me alone because I wanted to figure out entrepreneurship for myself. And sustainability has always been a core value of mine. I've had 5 heart surgeries. And so my childhood was very atypical compared to the regular person. And really what I did, Seth, was map over those same ideas that I used in human sustainability to take care of myself and really mapped it over into entrepreneurship. And then I went even more meta into building a sustainability company. And so Community Solar Authority has been around for over the last half decade. We're a stakeholder in the National Community Solar Partnership. And really, we serve as full service consultants to some of the most significant solar developers in the country, essentially helping them in the collective mission of deploying as many renewable assets as possible. And this is at a nationwide level. So some states have better incentives than others, as I'm sure you can imagine. But essentially, we work with landowners and also large, you know, rooftop owners who are seeking to generate value add from their real estate in order to monetize it further using these solar assets.
So we can't just gloss over this 5 heart surgery thing. What happened there?
So I was born with a lot of congenital heart issues. I had a narrow aortic valve. The doctors gave me an emergency surgery as soon as I was born. So they went in through my wrist. I had what's called an ablation, and they essentially broke my aortic valve, and it was then leaking blood. So I had 2 emergency surgeries as soon as I was born, 3 more in high school. A week before I graduated high school, I had my 5th and final surgery, which was open heart surgery, and absolutely life-changing, if you can imagine. Yeah, but sure. Actually, in unexpected ways, it really flooded my life with compassion, and I'll share briefly. I was in the pediatric unit because I was still 17 at the time, and I was kitty corner to a young kid who had a similar surgery. I'll try to skip the goriness, but the only way you can leave the hospital after open heart surgery is you basically need to drain your chest of the excess blood. And so you have to walk. And it's very hard to walk with, you know, broken ribs and everything else. And I saw a 7-year-old kid, you know, walking up and down the hallway all alone by himself. And it just flooded my life with compassion and really changed the dial of my life and what I wanted to pursue and what I thought was important. And so, you know, again, over the last decade, I've also moved 40 plus times, essentially living out of my suitcase, just with the intent of being an explorer and trying to soak in as much of life as possible. So it definitely changed my life. And like I said, planted the seed for what sustainability was actually going to do for me. And really, my intention is just to help larger entities and organizations think about the same way I thought about through my own life.
That's interesting. I can totally see how that would change your perspective on life. And yeah, it's awesome, man. It sounds like you're all good now, or is everything like stabilized at this point?
Healthy as ever. Yes, thankfully. Yeah.
Cool. Well, so what drew you to specialize in solar energy aside from, you know, your prior life experience and the inspiration, you know, with your heart issues and all that? Was there, did you take any other professional career path before you landed up here? Or like, did you just jump right into this?
No. So like I said, I've been in the energy space for a decade now, community solar and renewables for about half of that. But my first 5 years, I was actually in the direct sales space in the electric and gas industry. So really helping energy supply companies think through their direct sales channels, building teams, and really just working through those kind of strategies. It was back in 2018 when I really saw the writing on the wall with renewables and basically the amount of the trajectory and job security, the US and really from a global intention to deploy as many renewables as possible. If you look at the year-over-year growth of solar and expected growth rates, was too incredible to pass up for me. And I said, you know what? If I already have this experience working with large consumers of electricity, municipalities, investors, business owners, really, how can I take this into a higher opportunity vehicle, provide a greater impact, and really help think through how to do this in a simple way? And so that's really the tagline that we approach is simple sustainability. Meaning that the world of commercial solar can be incredibly complicated. Yeah. And when it comes to working with any of the facets that we do, because again, we work as full cycle consultants. So even helping, you know, the landowner understand what this is going to look like over a 20-year period to actually working with, you know, like corporations or national retailers, think about their deployment strategy for ESG commitments. The whole thing can be very confusing. And our intention is just to streamline that in a very concise way so that people can make the easy decision to be able to access and benefit from the world of renewables.
So I mean, a lot of our audience is land investors or land flippers, people who normally buy land and, you know, sell it relatively quickly just to make a profit between the, yep. the delta between their buy and the sale price. And buying a property to use it for solar, whether they keep it and lease it out to a solar energy company, or, you know, maybe the next guy wants to do that. Like, who is your typical client? Like, it's a landowner who owns how much land, and like, where is that land exactly? And like, what does the profile need to look like for you to even get involved and be like, yeah, you should consider this, versus, no, this doesn't make sense for you, don't do it.
Sure. No, that's a fantastic question, Seth. And I think that one of the things I'd like to do is either put it in your potential newsletter or just in the show notes. I think I had sent you our landowner's guide to solar leasing, which really spells out how to easily, you know, qualify your land and make sure it's a good fit. But I'll give you the brief rundown here. So when it comes to solar assets, our typical landowner, or potentially I'll also use municipalities because they always have the extra incentive to do something similar, which is, hey, I've got vacant land. Hey, I've got a waste fill, or, you know, whatever it is. How can we monetize this? But our typical landowner could be a farmer or just an investor, like you said. One of my managing partners is also a land flipper. And so he was coming into this with a lot of additional knowledge as to, you know, what people were interested in and how they were doing it from the owner financing perspective of, you know, basically buying and then reselling that land. But typically on the community solar side, so there's two types of solar assets that we invest in and help other people do the same. There's a community solar asset, which is typically 10 to 30 acres, and that's going to build anywhere from a 1 to 5 megawatt facility. That's solar verbiage. They don't need to know, but essentially it's how many panels are going on that land and how much power is going to be produced every single year. And so based on that 10 to 30 acres, we'll essentially look at that available space. And obviously there are other qualifications. It needs to be close to what's called a substation. It needs to have certain power lines called phase 3 power lines. And I think it's also worth mentioning, Seth, that when we work with landowners, we do all of this turnkey. So what we like to do is have people get a good idea of like, oh, I've got, you know, maybe 40 to 50 acres. We'll take the 30 of those and we'll transform it into solar. We'll go through and do the entire checklist to qualify it to make sure it's legitimate. And then we'll actually run an internal, what's called an RFP, and we'll just go to every single one of our solar developers that we work with, which again are amongst the largest in the nation, backed by many banks who have this collective interest. And we'll basically come back and shop around and bring back the best deal. And we don't charge a single dollar for our service. We get paid as consultants based on how much renewables we deploy. And so again, we're very streamlined in the fact that we get landowners the highest price of a lease, and we're not affected by and don't charge for our service. So it's a very complimentary thing. So 10 to 30 acres is what it looks like on the community solar side. But then there's also what's called utility scale. And so this could be 50 to literally 500 acre parcels that we look at. And the difference, Seth, is that community solar is available in about 30 states right now based on pilot legislation to fully completed legislation. But with utility scale, almost every single utility across the country needs to have some sort of blend of clean energy in their group of what they power. And so a lot of it's powered on brown dirty energy. But then these utilities will also own 100 acres of solar farms. And that's used to blend their portfolio into clean energy. And so we do both. Community solar is the smaller scale, but then there's obviously people who have tracts of land. So for example, we're looking at over 800 acres in Virginia right now. And that legislation for community solar isn't necessarily available. But again, in states where you wouldn't think about the opportunity to monetize your land, in states like Kentucky or you know, a lot of the Bible Belt or southeast of the United States, all of those make for fantastic locations for these utility scale projects.
So it sounds like if my property is less than 10 acres, I shouldn't even be thinking this way, right? Is 10 acres kind of like the minimum to even go down this road?
Yeah, when it comes from a leasing perspective, for what we do at least, exactly. There are times where, you know, I'll give you a very niche example. We had a guy who was a consultant for us. He worked for us, and he had about 7 acres of land, which could build like a small PV system. So nothing for a solar lease, but he also happened to live across the street from a college, a university. And so there are the times where you could build an asset on your property. It would be less than, again, a megawatt of power, which you could potentially sell to an end user. a university, a municipality, et cetera. And so it's not that it's ruled out completely, but for the sake of what we do, just to put parameters around it, we work in that 10 to 30 acre space. And I think that that's probably the most wise. There are probably better ways to monetize your land if you're under that.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. And also just think about other boxes that would need to be checked for this to be a viable option at all. And, you know, I'm not the pro. I don't know what to think of, but I'm thinking of, like, you know, how much sunlight is available at that place year round and like how close it is to the power grid, that kind of thing. What does that need to look like? Like, does this only work in Arizona or places? I think of like where I'm at in Michigan, where the sky is gray half the year, or maybe everything's covered with snow. Like, does this kind of thing not make sense in those parts of the world?
Yeah. So contrary to popular belief, that's a great point, Seth. Many people think that the production factor of solar isn't as, you know, useful in states like New York, where I'm from, or Michigan, where you're at, compared to Arizona, which does have a partial truth to it. But the reality is that, you know, New York State, for example, is one of the leading community solar states, one for their policies and the way they do politics. But Michigan also has this legislation that's coming through the pipeline. So a quick idea to think about as far as a checklist in order to qualify land. Again, it's got to have easy access. And so meaning it can't be in the middle of a, you know, we just reviewed some area for the BSA, the Boy Scouts of America. I'm an Eagle Scout. So I reached out to them and they sent us a couple camps that were completely wooded. And so, you know, we have no interest in deforesting land compared to putting it on a site that has the best and highest use case for renewables, like a waste fill or a quarry or something to that nature. So it's got to have easy access. Typically, like I said, it's going to be this 10 to 30 acre threshold. And then again, on the other side is like 50 to 500 acres. Typically, we're looking for state and local incentives to where, again, we can essentially bring back the best lease price. And again, just as a broad range, we see anywhere from $875 to $1,200 as a going per acre per year lease rate for land. But I've seen as high as $5,000 an acre in the states where you have state and local incentives that can really juice up the price. And again, part of our mission is to bring a fair practice all the way down so that these solar developers aren't necessarily not ripping off the landowners, but we're in the interest of making sure the landowner gets the best deal. I've seen farmers literally be able to retire and, you know, because oftentimes they're old and they don't have the ability, they have to keep working essentially. And so just as a total side note, like we have a collective interest in that. The land typically needs to be flat, bare, and not in a floodplain. So if anything's like labeled in a marshland for zoning, we typically stay away from stuff like that. It's got to be close to a substation, and that substation needs to have essentially room, what we call capacity lines, to build solar energy. So oftentimes, these substations have not been upgraded by utilities, and the utilities try to pass that responsibility on to solar developers. Mm-hmm. Because we work with some of the most significant in the country, actually globally as well, these guys can invest up to, we've seen $2 to $5 million in substation upgrades. And so oftentimes, you know, we'll have landowners where they're like, hey, we tried to do solar in the past and we were told it wasn't possible. We're able to come in and make it possible because we can afford these substation upgrades. Mm-hmm. It's got to be close to power lines, which again are the big, they're called phase three power lines. And so they basically have three levels to them. And that's basically what allows these solar farms to interconnect into the power grid. It's obviously got to receive adequate sunlight, which is like the least of factors, because again, you still receive solar production on cloudy days. You still receive solar production on, you know, panels that have snow on them. Obviously not as much. And that's why O&M gets taken care of by the solar developer, meaning a landowner isn't going to be out there scraping snow off the panels if they choose to lease out their land. And I had mentioned that it's got to be close to a substation. So I know I just spit a lot of information. Again, this is going to be in our landowner's guide, but that's essentially the checklist that we go through and confirm before we start shopping it around, trying to bring back a solar lease.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to have a link, free download. You don't have to opt in anything. It'll be in the show notes, retipster.com/173, if you want to download that. And it's very well done. So I definitely recommend checking that out. But with all the stuff you just mentioned there, Dakota, so some questions were coming up as you were talking. These might be dumb questions, because I'm not familiar. So just to confirm, when you say substation, what is that? Is that like where the solar farm plugs into the power grid to get dispersed everywhere else? Is that what that is?
Yeah. So a substation is essentially, they are very small lots where the utility will build exactly that. It's basically where the interconnection happens. And so you'll see these blown from the power lines. You'll drive by them oftentimes in rural areas, and they'll usually be gated off. And it will essentially be there. It's owned by the utility, and it is how everything gets plugged into the power grid. Exactly. So you'll know when you drive by them, they basically look like very large HVAC units, I guess. Is the easiest way to describe it. And typically like a quarter acre lot or something like that.
Yeah, I think I can visualize what you're talking about. Kind of ugly things that just look like a bunch of electric stuff happening there.
That's a substation. Yes.
Yeah. So say I just bought a piece of property. It's 10 plus acres. All the other boxes seem to be checked. It's flat, bare land with no trees, and it's not in a floodplain and all this stuff. Is there like some map I can go to like look at all the substations near me to figure out, hey, there's a substation there. Maybe this makes sense. And like, how far away does the substation need to be? Is it like a mile, 10 feet, like, I don't know, football field?
Yeah, no, great questions. So there are maps. The utilities do make it complicated to find these maps. We have a GIS land team essentially that goes through and they check all of this stuff. If you were trying to do it on your own, you would just need to do a Google search of, you know, my utility, whatever it is. For me, it's Ameren in St. Louis in Southern Illinois. So it's like Ameren's substation maps. And with a little bit of research, you can essentially start to look at the hosting capacity. And again, so you typically want to be less than 10 miles from a substation. The closer, the better. Mm-hmm. And, you know, typically we see these off like major highways, stuff like that. When it comes to the hosting capacity, again, you want to look for two things. So you want to make sure that the substation is available. You want to make sure it's close, and you want to make sure that it has capacity for solar. And so again, even if you are close to a substation, there might not be any additional capacity because there's already solar farms surrounding it. And that's a good indicator of if it's going to be viable or not. If you live in an area where you see there are solar farms, they are going to most typically be plugged into the, you know, a substation close to your parcel of land. And again, oftentimes there are megawatts of power available. And so again, if you've got 10 to 30 acres and it reveals that there are, you know, 1 to 5 megawatts of hosting capacity available and that substation is close, that would be considered a prime spot for a solar lease.
Is there any kind of a nationwide map that shows where all the existing solar farms are located, just to kind of get a feel for like, hey, there's a cluster of them over here. Maybe there's opportunity.
Yeah, there's not that I know of, although that would be extremely helpful. And I think, you know, one of the reasons why, Seth, is because obviously solar and renewables has been around for a long time. Actually, the longest standing solar farm, I believe, is being used by the military. And it's been around for, I want to say, over 100 years, and it's still generating power today. So these things can definitely last a long time. But recently, especially with the updates in legislation, we add, and I say we as in the U.S., adds maybe 5 to 10 additional community solar markets per year. So the surge of solar farms going up right now is actually like at an incredible pace. But I would love to have some sort of person track that, because it would definitely be able to help people understand like, hey, is this a good opportunity or am I just kind of wasting my time here?
Yeah, it sounds like when you mentioned, you know, are there any state or local incentives, you know, to get the best price and that kind of thing? Correct me if I'm wrong, but it sounds like politics are involved with this, like depending on who gets into office.
Very much so.
So like, I don't know, say if it was Trump or Biden, like, does that mean, okay, this is going to take off or it's going to die? Or I don't know, how big of a difference would that make?
It's a great question. So I'll tell you that with the Inflation Reduction Act, that really set the pace for renewable energy growth, which is very much a Democratic policy in terms of the renewable sector. Many Republicans want to slash parts of that bill, which would be bad for solar growth. But on the same stroke of the pen, community solar is considered very much bipartisan, meaning that it's a conservative approach to utilizing renewable energy. And I think a part of the reason why is because when we're building these solar farms, again, you can lease this land, and so a farmer can take advantage of it. Once you build 10 to 30 acres of solar panels, those solar panels typically get divided up into what's called subscribers. So my company helps fill these solar farms with large consumers of electricity, and small businesses and residential customers are also allowed to join. And so instead of having a singular off-taker basically take the power of this, it is a way for communities, oftentimes rural communities that otherwise couldn't install solar, same thing with urban. Basically, everybody has the power to benefit from renewables, and that's why community solar legislation, we're watching it go nationwide. Now, when it comes down to additional incentives, like you had mentioned, back to the IRA, there are specific pieces of legislation within that that allow for, you know, what's called adders, where you can claim additional tax credits, essentially making the deal more lucrative for solar developers, let's say in areas where they are considered what's called an energy community or a low-income area. And so oftentimes our work revolves around working with affordable housing communities or low to moderate income subscribers so that the developers can capture that additional value add. And again, we like to make sure that that goes all the way down to the person actually leasing the land to make it a full circle kind of deal on that perspective.
And when you said easy access earlier, what exactly does easy access mean? Does that just mean like there's a direct road access from the road, or like say if I, you know, got an easement that's big enough for like one truck to go through and that goes like a mile back into this property and then you can get there. Like how easy does it need to be?
Yeah. So it really depends on what developer we're talking to and who really wants to take on the project. That should be fine in most case scenarios, Seth. We say easy access, and I'll give you an example. Someone passed me some land. It was about 45 acres. He was super excited to do it. And it was in the middle of the Adirondacks, which is like upstate New York mountain ranges. And when I say like middle of nowhere, you could drop someone off on like Survivor and that would be like their territory. Yeah. And there was no phase three power lines. There was no easy access to be able to get to his parcel. It was surrounded by other parcels that really didn't have any access point. And you do need to be able to get trucks back there. You need to be able to get the panels back there. So, you know, typically it's not as, again, it's one of the lower priority as far as the checklist goes, but it is something that we check for. So in your scenario, like, hey, I've got an easement, I've got an access point, it goes a mile down the road. As long as we can fit trucks back there, typically that's going to be good enough. And again, we just mention it so people, you know, aren't sending us parcels of land that we're just going to automatically disqualify because it's in the middle of nowhere.
And when you said $875 to $1,200 per acre, was that per month or per year? I couldn't remember if you actually said that.
Yeah, so that is per acre per year. And so this will typically come, the way that it works is that the first couple of years are all dedicated to some sort of study. So those can be environmental studies, interconnection studies, and this is a time when no construction takes place on the parcel. Mm-hmm. If all goes smooth, Seth, it will typically be 12 to 18 months to get through this process. And the landowner can expect to receive small milestone payments. So while these studies are going on, they might get a few thousand bucks a year, maybe $10,000 a year, just for the solar developer to basically tie up that land, do the studies, and as long as the studies look good, they'll move forward and develop. Now, oftentimes people can go through these studies and they end up not working out, which is a downside. And that's part of the reason why we built this guide and we built this process, because we like to do all of the qualifying work on the front end. So like we like to check the substation, we like to check the phase three power lines. We like to do all of that work up in the front so that one, we're decreasing the likelihood that this project's going to be dropped later and really increasing the rate of success. And so the first couple of years are all dedicated to these interconnection studies. They'll receive small milestone payments. And then typically there are two phases. One's called NTP, which is notice to proceed. And that means everything checks out and you're ready to move forward with the construction of the project. The developer will then go and build the solar asset. And once it turns on, also known as COD, commercial operations date, that landowner will start to receive those yearly lease payments in the form of a single payment per year across the next 20 to 25 years. Mm-hmm. There are typically options in there, so like 10-year options, 5-year buyouts, et cetera. But we've never seen a landowner stop wanting to monetize their land. So for us, that's never happened. And that's the expected per lease rate. Like I said, the $875 to $1,200 is pretty standard across the board. And again, I'm speaking at a nationwide level. So this could be a lot higher in certain markets and a little bit lower in other markets.
Does that annual lease payment like step up each year to keep up with inflation? Or is it just like, nope, $875 a year, that's what it is for the next 25 years?
Sure. No, oftentimes there are escalators. They're small, you know, typically 1% to 2% escalator payments for that landowner, which, you know, isn't much, but we do consider that when it comes to like inflation and everything else. And typically, almost every single time, the solar developer is responsible for any increase in taxes. So there's really no worries from the inflationary standpoint, other than you want to monetize and make as much money to live otherwise. But as far as like land increases, insurance, the developer takes on that responsibility.
Yeah, that's actually going to be my next question is, does the property taxes go way up since it's now an improved property? But is it set up like a triple net lease where the, you know, the solar farm pays for everything involved, or how does that work?
Yeah, exactly. And so I've had, you know, people ask if they could like cut the grass and get a higher lease payment, and which I think is a great idea, like thinking ahead about like how to get the most out of it. But really, the answer is yes. So the developer takes care of everything front to back. And so again, this is very much just them leasing out the property. It's completely hands-off passive income. So any operations or maintenance, any snow removal, any grass that needs to be clipped or panels that need to be washed, everything's completely turnkey for the landowner.
Is the developer essentially the same as the long-term owner? Or does the developer build it, then they sell it to some other entity, and then they are the tenant that pays for that lease?
On the strategy of the developer, so we work with both. We work with asset owners, which can oftentimes be banks or the companies that the banks own, essentially. And so we're partnered with the longest standing, most bankable asset manager in the community solar space. They're called Community Solar Platform. They manage assets across the entire country. And so what we'd like to do, Seth, in the spirit of being full service, is that if we're working with a landowner and we're identifying that they're going to be a good fit, the last thing that we want to do is work with an organization that might potentially go under, or, you know, selling the project is really no big deal. That's actually very common in the community solar space. Many times people will build the projects, and then once they get to interconnection, that interconnection typically costs at least $500,000+, oftentimes in the millions of dollars. And those construction companies and EPCs simply can't afford it. And so they'll sell to much larger asset managers and other developers, essentially, that own portfolios of these projects, which is typically a good thing. Because again, you want to make sure that that asset is being managed by someone who knows what they're doing, someone who has the tenure and experience to do that long term, because these assets are going up for decades at a time. And also, like, just as a total side note, there's always peace of mind with decommissioning bonds thrown into this, so that the landowner knows that should this project come to the end of its life cycle and they're not going to renew their lease, but that solar farm is going to be taken down and it's going to be appropriately brought back to its original standpoint as far as the parcel of land goes. Another point worth mentioning is a lot of times people have questions about whether or not these solar panels affect soil quality. I think that it's called Jack Solar Farm. I believe they're over in Colorado. They do a fantastic job of doing these types of studies with what's called agrivoltaics, which is essentially dual-use solar farms. They'll have the solar on top, and they'll grow things like berries and herbs along the bottom. And so when it comes to decommissioning and returning a land back to its original state, there have been no studies to suggest that the solar panels or the solar farms affect any of the soil quality or otherwise, you know, ruin that value of the land. And in fact, it's one of the, no pun intended, it's one of the cleanest ways to monetize that land and then obviously bring it back to its original life, if that's what a landowner chooses to do at the end cycle.
Does it ever make sense for a landowner to just like try to build their own solar farm and then sell that power to the local utility company? Or is that never how it works? Or is that just not a smart way to go about this?
A lot of co-development work, Seth. And oftentimes it's not with landowners, but it can be with, again, people like municipalities, larger organizations. Commercial real estate companies love us because you'll see in the news a lot of times, like the big boys of commercial real estate, CBRE, Crow, these guys are adding renewables as a way to create value add because they have the portfolios of properties and they know that they can claim the tax equity and tax incentives if they build it themselves. Mm-hmm. And so oftentimes we'll go into co-development relationships where it's like, hey, we have the access to develop and build. If you want to own this long-term, you can absolutely do that. If you want to turn it into an asset that's just selling power back into the grid, again, it's not typical for landowners to do that, but it is possible. And again, you know, part of what we do is in identifying. So if people check out our landowner's guide, they want to send us their land for review. Again, it doesn't cost you a single dollar. We'll do it all for free. We'll get it qualified. We'll essentially be able to come back and we'll say, hey, what's your intention? Do you want to lease this land? You could potentially sell it to us if we're interested in buying it. We have investors that we work alongside of that buy up these properties, and then we'll go do exactly that. We'll go develop it, turn it into our own asset, and then either sell it back into the grid or sell it to a developer. But the opportunities there, there are multiple ways to kind of monetize the land. And it comes down to what a landowner wants to do.
You know, I've got a self-storage facility where we have a little over 27,000 square feet of storage buildings with flat roofs, and I've thought about putting solar panels on the roof. I haven't really looked into it. I don't know if it's smart or not, but in that kind of situation, I guess my assumption was I would own the solar panels and sell power back to the you know, energy company, however that works. But I mean, is it a smarter idea to like work with you and say, hey, can you find some developer out there who wants to put these panels on the roofs of our buildings? Or does that not make sense for some reason?
Actually, you know, I just saw Public Storage came out. They're working with a company called Solar Landscape out of Jersey, who is doing a fantastic job of media coverage for the solar world. It is very wise for storage companies to be able to use that as value add. You know, there again are multiple opportunities. The easiest one is simply to just lease your roof and let the solar developer take care of it. Mm-hmm. Again, you know, not everybody necessarily wants the, because if you were to sell the power back yourself, you'd typically be responsible for the O&M, mm-hmm. which, you know, isn't the worst thing in the world, but you don't want to have to clean 27,000 square foot of solar panels as an additional job, typically. If I had to guess based on what you do. So oftentimes, you know, working with storage facilities, which, you know, we're in very beginning relationships with several of them, it's a fantastic play. Again, for the same exact reason. It's value add to your real estate and it's passive income, and you don't necessarily have to take care of any part of it. So again, based on the state and where that's at, we'll determine which legislation makes it fruitful and really what it looks like. You know, again, for example, a state like Rhode Island, we're working on a mall over there right now, one of the biggest in the state. And the roof didn't really work out. So we're doing carports, which is very much different than a roof. But my point is that Rhode Island, for example, has some of the highest utility rates in the country. And so when it comes to the lease rate, it's not that powerful of a lease, but we're utilizing carports here as kind of a multi-tool so that it's protecting cars. It's giving the coverage. It's taking care of the snow plowing for the parking lots because the O&M's taken care of. And so again, part of the creative process on our end is like, hey, if you bring us an opportunity, we're going to come back and we'll give you all of our consulting advice for free in the assumption, but just in the spirit of providing as much value upfront as possible. And we'll give you options. We'll say, hey, here's what we think. Here's what we can do. You tell us what you want. And typically based on the consulting that we give and the access that we have, which is the bigger piece to it, because we have the access to pull these projects off at scale, typically people are like, okay, awesome, let's do it. And so I hope that provides a little bit of insight to that question.
No, for sure. I guess it just helps confirm I'm not crazy for thinking that, but I guess maybe one drawback would
You're very wise.
Yeah, well, thank you. I like hearing that. But if I, you know, if we were to agree to some kind of 20 plus year lease like this and they go on the roofs of our buildings, I would assume we're kind of stuck for 20 years or however long the lease is. Like if I want to knock those buildings down and build something else there, I can't really do that because that lease is there. Is that accurate?
I'll give you an example. So same group over in Rhode Island, they had a beautiful 60,000 square foot strip mall and we were going to do solar. And the lease rate, I don't even remember what it was. It was decent, but we didn't factor in, well, it's not that we didn't factor it in. It's that they had an opportunity to monetize it in a greater way. So they ended up selling the strip mall because it had ocean view over on Rhode Island. And they sold it to a real estate developer for many millions of dollars, which ended up being a much more valuable play than just, you know, leasing out the roof for less than $100,000 a year. For the next 20 years, which again is great money, but they were able to just sell the building instead in the spirit of that developer wanted to build vertically and they were going to build condos on top of it with the ocean view. And so my point is that if you plan on developing, and again, we'll give people this advice up front to help them think through it, which is like, hey, if you plan on knocking down your storage facility in 10 years to do something else with it, maybe not the best fit. Same idea when people are considering, you know, I was talking to a manufacturer the other day in upstate New York. They're like, hey, we plan on exiting our business in 5 years. So you have a 10-year agreement in front of us. And I'm like, well, yeah, maybe you're not the best fit for actually joining one of these solar farms if you plan on exiting. So again, stuff to think through. And that's a really good point, Seth, is, you know, if you have better ideas for your property long-term, one of the things you are in this scenario is committed. And mm-hmm. so it's always important to consider that.
Yeah. On those, along those same lines, I've seen a couple of really creative ways that people have utilized solar panels in a way that kind of like kills two birds with one stone. Like, for example, There's this canal solar power project in India that I saw on Reddit this past year where they've got this big long canal and, you know, just having an open exposed area that water runs through where water is scarce and it's, you know, going to evaporate. It's like, hey, why don't we cover that with these solar panels? So we're not only, you know, saving and conserving the water and, you know, has less evaporation and heat on it, but also we're creating tons of surface area of solar panels, that kind of thing. Or like, you know, if you wanted to create a covered parking lot, you know, normally you could just put up a metal roof over that. But what if you just put up solar panels to act as your roof? And these things seem like brilliant ideas. Have you seen any other creative ways to like use solar panels that sort of accomplishes two objectives?
Totally. Yeah, what comes up first is my carport example again, because again, not only can you connect EV charging to that and kind of have it power itself, but again, you're shielding cars. And so any auto dealers that might be listening to this, we love working with auto dealerships as a way to, because again, they're being forced to deploy EV as that comes online more. But again, as a way to protect your assets underneath that roof and have the O&M taken care of, carport solutions are fantastic. Typically, they are the most expensive kind of product to make pencil, which is why the lease rates aren't always that great. But again, it's in the spirit of this dual use, highest use case of this. I've also seen the canals. I have a contact who actually reached out to me not too long ago. He's at a large real estate organization. And he said, Dakota, you know, I've got this canal and we want to put solar over the top of it. Not necessarily for, you know, making sure the water doesn't evaporate, but I have seen stuff like that. And, you know, we actually just did another deal a few months ago, executed a lease agreement on another mall in upstate New York. But this guy came back to us and said, hey, I've got three other parcels I want you to look at. Two are parking lots and one's a lake. So we're going to do a couple carport solutions and we're going to do actually will be our very first, if we can get it to execution, our very first floating lake solar project, which I think is very cool. There are so many use cases for dual use solutions. I saw, this is unrelated to what we do, but I saw basically a roll up solar. It was almost like, I guess, a roll of tape that they're using in the military for medics. And it's a way to do pop-up wound care for combat soldiers that get hurt in the field. They basically roll out 100 plus yards of solar panels, very much like a fire hose. You know, a fireman rolls out their hose. They roll it out and it instantly starts producing power wherever they're at. So they can set up basically a medevac shop right wherever they're at, which I think is really cool. And so I think a lot of these solutions that are coming out, we're just going to see more and more creative ways to kind of plug into, you know, the power of solar, but then also thinking about how can we get multiple uses out of this? I only think that's going to become more popular.
Yeah. I do wonder, kind of going back to the government policy stuff. So let's say I'm, you know, living in a time where the government policy is very supportive of solar farms and, you know, one is built, but then all of a sudden government policy changes the next year and all of a sudden they're less supported or even discouraged. Does that ever like come back to bite a solar developer? Like, oh man, you're going to start losing money now. You never should have built this thing. Or is it, does it simply slow things down? Like it's going to continue expanding, but it just kind of slows down depending on if somebody's in office who doesn't support it.
The latter, you know, I've never seen a case, which isn't to say that it's not true. I've just never seen a case where it's hasn't been a good idea. It definitely makes projects not as lucrative, which no solar developer or financier wants to hear. Mm-hmm. But I would say it more or less just slows it down more so than it does completely, you know, takes the opportunity away. There have been states like North Carolina, which take away their net metering policies, which can be disadvantageous for people who were looking to take advantage of solar. But again, like especially because utility scale will always have a blend of renewables in their portfolio. In the case where they're doing these 50 plus acres of utility scale solar, that will always be a part of the strategy, regardless of what the legislation is. I don't think I've seen an example of where that has happened yet. You know, community solar has been around for 15 plus years at this point. Again, the management partner that I spoke on, Community Solar Platform, these guys helped pioneer the program into existence. And so they've been at it for a long time. I can always kind of circle back and ask and get you that answer. But I don't think I've seen a case where that's necessarily been true.
So this is maybe not like totally relevant to you because, you know, it seems like you deal with, you know, larger parcels of land and commercial applications and that kind of thing. But sometimes I think about you know, putting solar panels on the roof of my house, or even getting like, I don't know, any kind of a, like a smaller scale solar thing just to generate energy, whether it's for like a residential generator or something like that. But I hear that solar panels are getting better and cheaper every year. Does it make sense to just like keep waiting 5 more years until the product is better before investing all the money into that kind of thing? Or is it better to buy it now? Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, again, definitely not my expertise. You know, I actually own a converted school bus that has solar panels on top, and cool. I get to be powered by the sun. And last summer, I was road tripping with my bus, and I always found it so cool how I always had a full charge, minus when I turned the AC on because it was so hot. I drank it very quickly. But the power of, you know, kind of liberating yourself with clean energy from that sense is really powerful. I would say it's based on what your intentions are and your end results are. Again, when you install solar on your home, you're never really freed from the grid, quote unquote, as people say, versus if you were homesteading, producing your own power. I think that's a totally different scenario. Again, when it comes to residential solar, I don't really have the expertise to speak to it. I mean, it doesn't hurt to look at what residential installer could bring you. Oftentimes, they completely replace your electric bill. And obviously, you now have a bill to the solar developer, which cuts your electricity costs. But to your point, Seth, solar technology is improving greatly. And again, this is full cycle, meaning that a lot of people complain about the fact that solar recycling, for example, isn't nearly where it should be. But over the next 10 to 20 years, that problem is going to be most likely solved in a very powerful way. Mm-hmm. And so it takes the adoption of this technology in order to improve the technology. But to your point, yeah, the solar panels that were around 5-10 years ago compared to what's available now is very different. And again, we're even seeing technology like the solar shingles come out, which are a very expensive solution, in my understanding. But I think to your point, if you did wait over the next couple of years because you could afford to, then I think, yeah, you know, that it really comes down to a person's options and what they think is best for their family. And I'm sorry, I can't give a better answer than that.
That's totally fine. Totally fine. So I often hear solar, you know, spoken about alongside wind energy for, you know, just because they're both green energy sources and that kind of thing. And a few years ago, I interviewed a consultant similar to you about wind energy and wind turbines and how that all works. And he was telling me, in the many things we talked about, one of the biggest drawbacks of solar power is that it requires a lot more land than wind energy does, where you just, you know, you stick that turbine there and it's a smaller little footprint. So this is your chance to strike back at those wind energy guys. What are the drawbacks of wind turbines where solar panels excel?
Awesome question. It's actually funny because I work with a lot of wind consultants as well. They'll actually come work with us as partners when their wind projects don't work out. Oh, cool. They'll turn around and say, hey, maybe you should do solar instead. Yeah.
So they're not sworn enemies with him or anything?
Not for me, at least. No, I find a lot of those wind guys valuable, you know, because they're working with a very similar demographic, you know, farmers, people with land. See a lot of offsite wind projects going on in like the oceans and stuff. Again, over in states like Rhode Island, I saw they had a really big bill that just passed. You know, I guess I can only speak to the fact that, again, I'm from upstate New York. So I grew up on a small town in between two cornfields right off Lake Ontario. But we've got a camp up towards the Adirondacks and what's called the Tug Hill Plateau. I remember seeing the transition from this just bare land. It's got to be hundreds of acres. I don't know the exact amount, but it is massive. I remember when the first wind turbine went up, and now when you drive through there, I was just there over the summer. I mean, it looks like it goes on as far as the eye can see of wind turbines and solar versus solar. But again, you know, there are projects that are hundreds of acres of solar farms. Again, you know, I'm in favor, going back to the technology question, I'm in favor of dual use. You know, if we can incorporate more agrivoltaics to accomplish farming on top of power generation, I think that's really wise. And I support that and embrace that. Contrary to what most people view as, you know, like what a solar guy would be, you know, again, my spirit of sustainability comes actually from my own life. It comes from the pillar of human sustainability. Oftentimes, when you get in the clean energy space, it does get clouded by politics. And so I'm someone who's very balanced. Like, I believe nuclear is just as important of a conversation as solar. And so I think oftentimes that comes as a refresher because people sometimes approach us and they expect us to have like a very linear way of thinking. And really, I'm in favor of one, understanding the complete details. I'm sure wind is complicated. There's not much I know beyond what I kind of just mentioned. But, you know, I think that there's a use for both of those projects. I could probably argue and disagree with the consultant that came on as far as, you know, like whatever else he had to say about solar. Because again, there are often times where helping a farmer retire is going to be of equal use as to, you know, putting a smaller amount of wind turbines if his intention was to be able to stop working. So that's my initial thought.
So I think I know the answer to this, but I'm just going to ask it straight up just to make sure I know the answer. So if I own land and I decide to lease it out to some developer or energy company to build a solar farm, are there any costs involved for me or is it just purely profitable?
So in the case of a roof, for example, people might need to re-roof, and that's obviously very expensive. In the case of land, there are typically no fees associated. And if there is like a survey or something, we'll make sure the developer pays for it. Mm-hmm. So if they come back, and again, just as a total side note, if there are listeners that may already have a proposal from a solar developer and you want a second opinion, happy to review your agreement and tell you if it's good or if they're, you know, trying to pull something, and happy to get second and third opinions and other proposals. But typically, there are no fees associated with doing this stuff. Again, like there may be, you know, the developer asks for a survey, maybe putting documents together or other legal fees for reviewing agreements. But that aside, no.
And I kind of talked about this earlier when you mentioned bare land. So does that mean like to build a solar farm, you can't chop any trees down? Like if I've got a, you know, 30 acre property that's just like packed with trees and we got a mobile down to, you know, put solar panels there, that's a deal breaker. Or like, all right, does it have to be truly completely nothing on there? Like if I got to chop down one tree, is that a deal breaker? Or help me understand that.
How many trees? No, that's a good question. You know, again, we're in favor of doing things for the best and highest use case. You can absolutely chop down 30 acres, profit from the timber, and then turn it into a solar asset.
Okay, gotcha.
Typically, that will need to be done before a solar developer takes interest in it. But again, if it's a smaller acreage where, you know, we're looking at 10 to 30 acres and a couple acres are wooded, we may be able to find a solar developer that would go ahead and take care of that or work it into the process so that maybe the lease rate's slightly lower because they're paying for the, you know, the trees to come down. So not to say it's not possible by any means. It's just, you know, if we had two parcels of land, they both looked good, but one was bare and one needed to be deforested in any way, we would take priority over the one that's already bare. And that's just from a, again, a streamlined perspective.
Okay. Like, so if I've got like 20 acres or something, and I really want this thing to get leased out to a solar developer, is there anything I can do to like make it look more attractive to them if it's not already done? Or is it one of those things where like, it is what it is? Like you can't put lipstick on a pig.
I mean, again, it really comes down to, like I said, about the zoning. So as long as the zoning looks clean, you could potentially grade it. So it's like the slope of the land. But again, I don't think it's necessary to do. It really comes down to, does it fit in these parameters that we talked about earlier? So from the substations, the hosting capacities, like those are the biggest factors when it comes to this stuff. It's not necessarily if the land is going to, you know, look pretty with the solar panels on it. So no. My answer is no.
I mean, are there any other preliminary assessments or preparations a landowner should make before approaching a solar company or before talking to you, or just pick up the phone and call you and you'll figure it out for them?
You know, luckily we have our GIS team that can work pretty quickly to determine if land is eligible or not. At this point, we're pretty much wide open across the country because of the legislation and intentions of development for the developers we work with. And so, again, they have endless appetites to be able to deploy as many renewables as possible. And so it's a little bit extra work for us on the front end because we're qualifying thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of land per year. But for us, it's worthwhile, at least at this point, because with the given parameters that we have, if people are sending us the 10 to 30 acres or 50 acres plus, from there, the work to do the substation checks, et cetera, it typically takes us 20 to 30 minutes to qualify a parcel. And so again, even if we get, you know, thousands of parcels a year, we're already invested in that interest of making that happen. So that's kind of where we sit with that. And, you know, I'm sure that will change as, you know, over the next few years, But right now we're pretty much wide open across the market for this stuff.
Do you have like a list of which states or counties or anything make the most sense for solar development? Like if you're in XYZ state, don't even think about it. Or if you're in this state, pick up the phone and call right now.
So for the latter, I would say, you know, if you're in states and you have land in places like Cali, New York, Illinois, Maryland, these are all very hot markets. There are other territories, you know, for example, there are energy grids across the country, one of them being called PJM, which is one of the primary in the country. They are kind of slowing down on their legislation and kind of getting locked up in policy. So for example, we were looking at a portfolio in Ohio, and that's not to say that it's not favorable, but right now it's like a slower state compared to other opportunities that I had mentioned. Again, if you know that your town where you locate your parcel, if there's no other solar farms around and there's what's called a moratorium where they just don't want any solar farms built, because again, it does go down to a local level. Oftentimes we'll need to go into board meetings and, you know, you'll have the one guy stand up and scream in how solar is going to ruin everything, which is fine. And I respect all opinions. But if that's going on, obviously it's probably not a good idea. But really, that aside, Seth, again, we're open to look at whatever you've got. If we get, 1,000 parcels of land as a result of this podcast, that's fine. We'll go through it. And again, it may take 20 to 30 minutes to qualify a full parcel, like all the way through. But if we get a bunch of stuff that doesn't qualify based on like, oh, it's in this particular state and it's got this particular legislation, or it's like less than, you know, basically if it doesn't fit, we'll kick out all of that stuff. And it may only take 30 seconds for us to look at and be like, oh, this is no good. Mm-hmm. In which case we would just send a very quick note back and say, hey, thanks for submitting, but this parcel doesn't look good for us.
Do you guys have like a form on your website or something where it's like, yeah, fill in your, parcel number and coordinates and name and all the stuff, and just an automated way of saying like, or is it like human eyes have to look at it every single time in order to make that determination?
An opt-in form. We don't have any automations as like, oh, hey, this is going to be a good fit, which actually isn't a bad idea. I might have to think on that, Seth. Yeah. You may have just given me a good idea. You know, it won't be accurate per se, but it's like, hey, like we think this is going to be a good fit. Our website is being redone. By the time this podcast comes out, I'm sure it will be out. So it's communitysolarauthority.com. We'll have a sector for land. People can essentially put in their land criteria and basically what they've got a hold of. I will make a note that we don't typically like to work with people who are like, oh, I want to buy this land. Would this qualify? The process to get through that is just a little bit too strenuous. So I will say if you fall into that category, we can certainly help you think through it. But as a general note, like we like to do deals with people who already own the parcel. Mm-hmm. Just as part of our simple sustainability tagline is all about streamlining it. Because again, we serve as consultants for these developers, and our mission is to just streamline it. And so I will make that note, but you can go to communitysolarauthority.com and plug your information in, and they'll be able to kind of submit their parcels and we'll be able to reach back out and let them know.
Yeah, I got you. So it sounds like based on that, it's not a good idea to speculatively buy a piece of land with the assumption that you'll be able to use it for solar. It's more of like that would be a plan B, like have something else in mind first, but you know, don't buy it assuming it's going to work out for this, because you can't really determine that before they own it, right?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. And again, it's really just in the spirit of we built our entire company based on partnerships, Seth. Mm-hmm. And so as part of our mission, we always like to start small and with pilot deals. And so we like to, because again, we have investors that work with us that do go and pursue land. They buy it up. They work closely with our internal team. We say, hey, this is a really good parcel. We know we're going to be able to monetize it, buy it up. But when it comes to like our first transaction together, we don't want that to be our first transaction together. Mm-hmm. We want it to be people who already have the land. They're like, hey, you know, I've been sitting on this 50 acres, or I've been sitting on these parcels. I've got, or a portfolio. You know, we work with like a trust, for example. They've got thousands of acres in a trust in a singular state. They passed it over to us. They said, here's 300 parcels. Which ones work? We love doing that because it just increases our hit ratio, essentially. And so that's really who we like to work with. But again, if people just have a single piece of land, again, we'll happily take a look as long as, you know, it fits into that criteria.
Are there any like risks associated with doing this? Like if I lease out my land to a solar developer and they do it, I mean, from what I'm gathering, it sounds like the main risk is just that I will probably be locked into this agreement for however many years, unless I can somehow terminate the lease agreement early, which I wouldn't normally expect I could do. But other than that long-term commitment, is there any, I don't know, like would it devalue the land in any way? Or would it, like, can you think of any reason why you wouldn't want to do this?
Again, if you plan on, and even if you did sell your land, that's okay. You know, people buy solar assets all the time, and they also buy the rights to have these parcels leased. So if anything, you could obviously take that monetization schedule that you have and say, hey, this parcel of land is 30 acres. It's currently leased at, you know, $50,000 a year on 50 acres. You buy this land and you are coming into $50,000 of guaranteed income. So really, there's a lot of advantages on that side. But to answer your question, typically, no, there's no way it devalues the land. There are really no opportunities, at least with the solar developers that we work with. I can't speak to this across the board. There's really no opportunities to lose here, which is the entire point of kind of working together in the spirit of this is a massive opportunity in history. With the intentions of deploying as many renewable assets, this is just really a piece of time right now where there's a window open for people to take advantage of the legislation in place and really benefit from the collective deployment of renewables. Again, a lot of people are, you know, it's going to the banks of the world that own all of this property. You know, we work with the corporations and the giant real estate companies, but we also love the hero stories of, again, the farmer that was able to retire, the family that was able to have the peace of mind for the rest of their lives that they were going to be able to live without fear of inflation. And so we push for those stories as much as we do for the large clients that are looking for the tax equity and to make the breaks and to get this. And so, yeah, I just think that it's a really valuable opportunity for those that, you know, obviously fit into the scope of what we're trying to do.
I think you kind of answered this question earlier, but like, say I put a solar farm on, a developer puts a solar farm on the property, 20 years goes by, and then that solar farm is removed. Are there any like permanent modifications made to the land that's like, okay, well, before you were able to do this, but now you can't anymore because that solar farm was there and that permanently changed something about it, whether it's like,
I don't think I've ever got that question before. Yeah. No, there's not. Again, like the advantage here is that when it comes to ground mounts, which is what we call them when they put them on the land, all of that is, again, in advantage of protecting the land and making sure that it can be returned to its original state. The backside of that is that if the 20 years is up, those developers typically don't want to move that. They might go and replace the panels, mm-hmm. but you can essentially keep that lease going. So if you're a young person and you've got this land, you can essentially just continue to lease that out every 20 years. And obviously the terms change, right? The price changes, et cetera. But you can keep going if you want to. Otherwise, no, it'll be decommissioned, returned to its original state. And again, the developer will be responsible for recycling those panels. So that land is returned as is. And there's nothing that I know of or could even imagine where work would be done on that land where you couldn't go and do something else with it. I'm like trying to imagine a scenario where maybe they like put gravel down, but like that's not even a thing. So I don't think so. No.
Is it a common thing for people to get these leases in place and then sell the lease while keeping the land? Like, for example, if I had a 50 acre property and half of that was, I don't know, a shopping center or something, and the other half was a solar farm. So I want to keep the whole property, but I want to sell off just that lease so I can get the cash now. Is that a common thing people do, or like a normal strategy that people take?
I have never heard of that, because I guess, like, are you saying it would be a separate parcel from the like strip mall, let's call it? Because if it's a separate parcel, you could obviously sell it.
I think that's one scenario. But the reason I asked this is because I interviewed a cell phone tower consultant similar to you, but he specialized in cell phone towers. And he was mentioning that was a not uncommon thing where cell phone tower leases are bought and sold, like just the lease, not the land underneath it. So I didn't know if that was normal for solar farms.
I actually have never heard of that. You know, I've got a friend who does the cell phone leasing as well, or the tower leasing. I've never heard of a scenario where people sell the rights to the lease to get, so I guess I can see why, because they want to keep the land, but they would be able to basically almost like an exchange to pull out the equity.
Yeah. It's kind of like selling a note or that, something like that.
Yeah. Which is obviously very common in what you do with the land flipping and what your audience does. I've actually never heard of that. Again, I'll have to come back and see if that's a thing. And if it is, we could throw it in the show notes.
Yeah, you bet. So as a land flipper and a land investor who's just always looking for different opportunities out there, what advice would you give me if I was, you know, scouring the country, trying to find markets where I can buy parcels of land that might not be, you know, this might not be the primary strategy, but it could be like a plan B? It sounds like I should be looking for parcels that are 10 acres and larger, preferably in a state or market where there are incentives for this kind of thing, with easy road access, preferably close to a substation. I don't know. Anything else I should put in my filtering criteria as I look around for potential properties for this kind of thing?
Yeah. I mean, again, almost in the spirit of doing it even easier, and this obviously creates a split, but if I were to run a strategy like that, I would do exactly that. So I would start to look around for pieces of land that might make sense, again, like open farms, et cetera. And I would actually probably even start with the partnership route. And again, this is just specific because this is how I build my entire business, is off of partners, right? And so again, we'll partner with wind consultants who may not be able to put their wind farms up, but their client still has a need to either generate income through a lease or slash, you know, electricity costs. And so they will pass as clients and will work in tandem. And so if I was running this plan for land, I would start to focus on farmers and other people where this land criteria kind of comes up. And I would say, hey, I want to help you monetize your land through solar leasing. And so instead of trying to take the full dive myself, like you said, and potentially find the land and then buy the land and then try to qualify it, I would just, again, as a starting point to keep it simple, I would just start partnering and say, hey, you know, I want to make a chunk of whatever your land lease is, or I'll, you know, let's do a flat fee. You only have to pay me if I get a solar developer to come build. So that way, again, it's very like Airbnb arbitrage style, where you are arbitraging other people's property and land, generating a solar lease. You can get a couple under your belt. And then from there, I would start to consider, okay, like, what does this actually look like for me to do? But again, I'm a very big believer in starting small and like de-risking the opportunity. So that's how I would start. And actually, like, that could be crazy lucrative. And again, we have people on our team that are simply 1099 contractors, but they are basically bird dogging land that way. They're going into partnership, finding a couple of those deals. And then after they get a few, they're starting to kind of build the opportunity larger and wider.
Now, how do you make your money exactly? Because I think you said that it doesn't cost anything for the landowner. Are you making your money from the developer in some way, or how does this become a profitable venture for you?
Yeah. So in this, no matter what we're doing, so from land leasing to actually installing solar for a real estate group to enrolling a, you know, a national retailer in a solar farm, we just get paid as simply an extension of the solar developers, what's called their origination teams. And so very similar to any sort of consulting work, we get paid a fee based on how many megawatts of power we either develop or enroll. And so again, when it comes to land leasing, we could charge for our service, probably not that much for landowners. But in the case of, like, you know, we work with national retailers and corporations, we could charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for what we do. We choose not to, again, for the sake of competition. There's a lot of sustainability consultants that don't execute and charge lots of money. And so we just kind of put the process in reverse, and we don't charge for our service because we know we're going to get paid based off of execution. And, you know, because we've been doing this for so long, and I come from the sales world, we're really results driven. And so again, we'll get paid based off of how much power we actually develop. And so other opportunities in land, Seth, sometimes developers will pay people just a finder's fee. So they'll pay them like $10,000 to $20,000, just as an example, for finding the land and bringing it to the solar developer, which again, can be lucrative for the right person, not our collective interest. Mm-hmm. We want to do the full life cycle. And so we're going in, making these deals with solar developers for the long term. We're finding the land. We're helping build and construct on the land. We're subscribing that solar farm once it's built. And then we're managing the asset long term over the next 20 to 25 years with our management partner. So a very different strategy compared to what other people are doing. But that's kind of like some insight into how we get paid. And again, there are opportunities for us to monetize elsewhere. We're just long-term players. And so that's how we think about things.
So it sounds like you get paid upfront and then also sort of long-term as you help manage it?
The opposite. We typically don't get paid on the land that we invest in for a long time. And so again, it will come in what's called milestones. The landowner will always get paid first. And if we get paid any sort of upfront money, we'll pay it to the person who brought us the deal. Mm-hmm. Right. And so again, like if we're working with consultants who brought us the land, we're like, just take all the upfront money so you get a payment. We're willing to wait because we make a lot of money for what we do elsewhere. And we don't need the cash flow necessarily from like a small milestone payment. And so again, part of the reason why it's cool to work with us is because we think in decades, where everybody thinks about like instant gratification. Mm-hmm. And so because we have the ability to think in decades like this, we are willing to wait a long time, invest right alongside the landowner to make sure that project actually goes through. And again, that just leverages the opportunity because we're invested in making it work and we don't believe in wasting our own time. So when we choose to, you know, work with landowners and say, hey, we want to do this for the long haul, they can believe us because, you know, we're very transparent in like our business strategy and how we think through things.
So as we wrap this up, I guess my closing thought is like, how do you see the future of land leasing for solar energy development in the next 5 to 10 years? Like, I don't know if there's ever going to come a day when this is like saturated or like we don't need any more solar farms or anything like that. But I mean, it sounds like clearly this industry is growing, maybe growing faster in some states than others. But do you kind of think that we're at the beginning of that growth curve or in the middle of it or near the end of it? Or how much more opportunity will there be in the future?
Yeah, so I think the opportunity is only going to grow. Who's to say how long of a window we have? But I think we have clearance at least for the next decade. And so again, I think in decades, so I'm committed to doing this for over the next 10 years. And I think that as I go on, I think a lot of cool things I see other people doing are like funds and syndicates for this type of stuff in the commercial real estate world, for example. And I would love to start doing that with solar farms. And again, partnering with people with audiences and networks, because from our side, we're invested in building these projects, but we also want to own and buy up our own land to run these strategies too. So again, we practice what we preach. My intention was to come on today and provide as much value on the subject as possible, but also, you know, let people know that this is the same strategy that I'm running internally at my company. Mm-hmm. You know, I co-founded Community Solar Authority over half a decade ago at this point, and we are in the collective interest of having land leases ourselves, buying up property and owning that for solar development. And so we're going all in on this area for at least over the next 10 years. And hopefully that kind of paints an arc as to like where we're thinking and what we're seeing out on the field.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Dakota, thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. I learned a ton from you. I'm sure a lot of people listening have as well. So just to recap, if people want to find out more about you or talk to you or figure out if their land is a good fit for this, do they go to, is it communitysolarauthority.com?
Yes. So that is our website. I would actually prefer if you come connect with me on LinkedIn. Okay. So that's linkedin.com/in/Dakota Malone. And the reason why is I create content on LinkedIn daily. I've been on there for over a year at this point. And it is a way for your listeners to be able to come on and actually have conversations with me. They can have obviously direct access and also continue to learn about a lot of the projects that we do and what we've got going on. But if you do have those 10 to 30 acres of land or 50 plus acres of land anywhere across the country, you own it and you're interested in a solar lease, you can go to communitysolarauthority.com, put your information in, and we'll reach back out to see if it's a good fit for some of the solar leasing that we're doing.
Awesome. And I will include a link to that LinkedIn profile in the show notes. Again, retipster.com/173. And if you people out there are listening on your phone, feel free to text the word free, F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. You can stay up to date on all things going on in the world of RE Tipster. Thanks again, Dakota. Thanks everybody out there for listening. And we will talk to you next time.
Thank you so much, Seth.
Hey,
Hey, folks, I hope you love what you just heard. Before you go, I want to make sure you're aware of the RE Tipster newsletter. This is something that we spend a lot of time pulling in content and conversations from throughout the RE Tipster community. We want to make sure you're aware of the hottest stuff that's going on right now. Things like active deals from other wholesalers in the community in the RE Tipster deal marketplace, or changes in the industry that affect you and you need to know about. And of course, I'm always sharing the latest software and tools and services that I'm using that I think you should know about. And if you followed RE Tipster for any length of time, you already know there's a whole lot more I could talk about because there's a lot that happens in our community each week. And this is stuff you really don't want to miss. And that's why it's so important for you to be aware of what's going on. All you got to do is take out your phone, maybe even the phone you're listening to right now. Go ahead and text the word free, that's F-R-E-E, to the number 33777. And we'll get you added to the email list so you get this newsletter and you're always aware of the most important things going on in our industry. Thanks again for listening. Again, just text the word free to 33777 and we'll get you squared away. Talk to you next time.